Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Awakening the Spirit of America, FDR's War of Words with Charles Lindbergh, and the Battle to Save Democracy, by Paul M. Sparrow. Narrated by Malcolm Hilgartner. Preface. No president in American history had a more significant impact on both American and world history than Franklin Roosevelt. He transformed the very concept of what a democratic government should do for its people, what rights its citizens have, and even what constitutes fundamental human rights for all people. In his battle to save democracy from fascism, to protect freedom and justice, he used every weapon at his disposal, his charisma and mellifluous voice, the power of the federal government, radio, newspapers, magazines, and boisterous rallies, all to shift public opinion in favor of supporting an ally in desperate need. Yet at the core of all of Roosevelt's weapons were his words. His words brought hope to a desperate world, comfort to those suffering hunger and deprivation, and a vision of a better world for those crushed by totalitarian oppression and hatred. This book seeks to put the listener in the room with FDR's team and his equally charismatic foil, the famed transatlantic pilot Charles Lindbergh, as they devise their linguistic strategy and craft the words that would decide the fate of all freedom-loving people. I was fortunate to serve as the director of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum for some years. After a long career in broadcasting and museum leadership, running a historically significant archive was a humbling experience. As I delved deeper and deeper into the collection, more than 17 million pages of documents, 10,000 pieces of art, 25,000 artifacts, 50,000 books, the power and impact of his words and deeds moved me. When I first entered the secure stacks of the FDR Presidential Library, operating under the auspices of the National Archives, I was familiar with the well-known narrative of his life. Over time, I came to understand a deeper truth. His remarkable success rested on a profound belief in the American spirit, the soul of America. The one aspect of the Roosevelt narrative that intrigues me the most is how incredibly relevant it is today. Nearly every major issue he dealt with in the 1930s and 1940s is still a part of our daily lives. Global conflicts, weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, income inequality, environmental degradation, propaganda and misinformation, authoritarianism, healthcare, social safety nets, racism, and anti-Semitism. In revisiting one of the most consequential periods of FDR's 12 years in the White House, I seek to provide some guidance for us today. Over a two-year period, from September 1939 until January 1942, President Roosevelt persuaded the world that free people could overcome the terror of mechanized militaries controlled by brutal totalitarian governments. Understanding why and how FDR was able to confront and conquer the grave challenges America faced then is the driving force behind this book. Examining his words and deeds provide lessons for us today in an America struggling with dangerous factions bent on undermining democracy. Today's political environment, where violent militias spout fascist ideology and anti-Semitism, is directly descended from the America First Committee that emerged during the lead-up to World War II. Neo-Nazi protesters, proudly wearing Camp Auschwitz t-shirts and shouting, "We will not be replaced," threaten attacks on Jews and deface synagogues in tactics that mimic the brown-shirted stormtroopers of Hitler's Germany. Now, as then, the spread of disinformation to undermine democracy and encourage racist, anti-immigrant, and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories poses an imminent threat. Hitler's invasion of Poland and the powerful political groups who opposed support for England and France are reflected today in political and media figures opposing aid to Ukraine in its existential battle with Russia. During his campaign for president in 1940, Roosevelt said this about the information war he was fighting. "Certain techniques of propaganda, created and developed in dictator countries, have been imported into this campaign. It is the very simple technique of repeating and repeating and repeating falsehoods, with the idea that, by constant repetition and reiteration, with no contradiction, the misstatements will finally come to be believed. They are used to create fear by instilling in the minds of our people doubt of each other, doubt of their government, and doubt of the purposes of their democracy. This specific period of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency reveals how FDR confronted isolationists, fascists, and anti-immigrant politicians with a clear vision for a better world. His hope that Americans would rise to the challenge of defending democracy was built on the founding principle of the United States, the commitment to fight for freedom. When Hitler plunged Europe into the chaos of World War II, and the British Empire teetered on the brink of collapse, the future of democracy rested on one man's shoulders. Franklin Roosevelt battled fierce resistance as he sought to provide support for Great Britain in its time of desperate need. The handsome and world-famous aviator Charles Lindbergh emerged as Roosevelt's nemesis and led the isolationist opposition to the president's efforts. Lindbergh spoke for many, and his allies included FDR's own ambassador to Great Britain, Joseph Kennedy, media titan William Randolph Hearst, and automobile tycoon Henry Ford. President Roosevelt had his own allies, chief among them Prime Minister Winston Churchill. The two men forged a transatlantic partnership hailed as the most important alliance in American history. Roosevelt's team of advisors and writers included Harry Hopkins, a New Dealer who became the president's closest advisor, Judge Samuel Rosenman, who started helping FDR with his speeches in the late 1920s, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Robert Sherwood, who added poetry and passion to Roosevelt's prose. And, of course, his wife Eleanor Roosevelt, the most influential First Lady in American history. All helped him in his fight for the soul of America and the battle between democracy and fascism. During his 1936 campaign for re-election, Franklin Roosevelt told his supporters that this generation has a rendezvous with destiny. That simple phrase set the tone of Roosevelt's leadership for the rest of his life. Alone among American leaders, he foresaw early on the danger Hitler and fascism posed for democracy and freedom around the world. While many, including Charles Lindbergh, praised Hitler and his resurgent Germany as the world struggled through the Great Depression, Roosevelt saw a madman intent on global domination. Most Americans wanted nothing to do with war in Europe, and FDR faced an enormous challenge in convincing them the United States had a moral responsibility to rise to the occasion and embrace its destiny as a superpower. Amid drama, conflict, and tension, Franklin and his team confronted entrenched antipathy and impossible deadlines as they labored to change public opinion. Night upon night, Winston Churchill and the British people struggled to survive bombing raids Hitler believed would break that nation's spirit. A German invasion seemed imminent. If the United States did not provide military supplies, food, and fuel, the British Empire would fall. President Roosevelt strained against the strictures of the Neutrality Acts, which prevented him from providing arms to belligerent nations. The campaign to win the hearts and minds of Americans took place on the battlefield of public opinion, primarily delivered by way of radio and the print media. His opponents also relied on mass media and political rallies, often with clandestine support from Nazi Germany. Soon after the invasion of Poland, Lindbergh utilized his boyish charm, good looks, and heroic status to rally millions to his cause. His passionate belief that America should remain neutral arose from his profound admiration for Germany, his disdain for Great Britain, and a deeply hidden anti-Semitism. His strong opposition to war echoes his father's pacifist stand during World War I, when he was one of only a handful of congressmen to vote against the United States' entry into the war. He also harbored resentment toward the freedom enjoyed by the press, having suffered under the glare of tabloid flashbulbs after the tragic death of his infant son. One reporter went so far as to sneak into the morgue to photograph the murdered baby's corpse. Franklin Roosevelt had faith in the American people, and fought back with words of his own. His devoted writers and advisors helped him construct a compelling and persuasive case against fascism that encouraged people to believe in democracy and its future. The alliance between Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, forged in the fires of war, defeated the forces of hatred and oppression, and created the world we live in today. It is a world that is far from perfect, but also far from the mass murder and destruction of the mid-20th century. My hope is that Franklin Roosevelt's belief that the American spirit will rise to any challenge when freedom is threatened will inspire others, as it has inspired me. Paul M. Sparrow, Lewis, Delaware. Part 1. The War Begins. 1. God Help Us All. Washington, D.C., September 1939. President Roosevelt's private secretary, Marguerite Missy LeHand, was sound asleep in her third-floor bedroom at the White House when her bedside telephone rang, startling her awake. It was shortly after 2:45 a.m. on September 1, 1939. She answered and heard the voice of William Bullitt, the American ambassador to France. Normally charming and flirtatious, he was a suitor of hers, Bullitt's manner was hard and brusque. "I need to speak to him right away. I just heard from Ambassador Biddle in Poland," Bullitt said. "The Germans have attacked. Can you tell the switchboard to put me through to his room?" "Oh, my God," she exclaimed. "Yes, hold on." Overnight operators had orders not to wake the president without an okay from Missy, who controlled access to Roosevelt night and day. She ran downstairs to the president's bedroom and woke him. The operator put the call through. Roosevelt picked up the handset. "Mr. President, I just got off the phone with Biddle," Bullitt said. "It's bad." The president and his assistant listened as Bullitt explained that German forces had crossed the Polish border in massive numbers and were bombing cities and slaughtering civilians. When Bullitt finished, the president sighed. "Well, Bill, it has come at last," he said. "God help us all." Roosevelt hung up and sat in silent thought. Taking up the notepad and pencil he kept at bedside, he recorded a message for posterity. "The president received word at 2:50 a.m. by telephone from Ambassador Biddle through Ambassador Bullitt that Germany has invaded Poland and that four cities are being bombed. The president directed that all Navy ships and Army commands be notified by radio at once. In bed, 3:05 a.m., September 1st, 39, FDR. The president immediately called the Secretaries of State, Army, and Navy, and gave them the news. Assistant Press Secretary William Hassett notified the media and went on the radio announcing the German invasion. World War II began in Germany at 5:40 a.m., when Adolf Hitler, surrounded by his top military leaders, declared, "The Polish state has refused the peaceful settlement of relations which I desired, and appealed to arms. In order to put an end to this lunacy, I have no other choice than to meet force with force from now on." As dawn was breaking over Poland, German artillery, tanks, and 42 divisions of jackbooted troops unleashed a fusillade on unsuspecting Poles. Thousands of Luftwaffe bombers and fighters dropped death on peaceful cities, while Wehrmacht armored battalions and infantry raced across the land, introducing the tactic of Blitzkrieg, or lightning war. In the face of overwhelming force, the Polish army displayed incredible bravery. Desperate to slow the attack, about 250 Polish cavalrymen charged an invading infantry unit, driving off the enemy foot soldiers, until German armored trucks mounting heavy machine guns laid waste to the men on horseback. Nearly a third were killed or wounded. Hitler, wearing Wehrmacht field gray to address a hastily assembled Reichstag, pledged to remove his uniform only in victory or in death. Radio, his favorite propaganda tool, broadcast his vile, lie-filled speech worldwide. Franklin Roosevelt was among the millions listening, and at 5 a.m., he called his wife Eleanor, who was at their home in Hyde Park, New York, and told her to tune in. In harsh tones that dripped scorn and anger, the Führer claimed the Poles had forced his hand by thwarting his numerous attempts to achieve a peaceful solution to the Polish problem. He bragged about having enlisted a new ally, the Soviet Union. I am happy particularly to be able to tell you of one event. I no longer see any reason why Germany and the USSR should still oppose one another. We have therefore resolved to conclude a pact which rules out forever any use of violence between us. Russia and Germany fought against one another in the World War. That shall and will not happen a second time. Hitler's announcement of a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union was a stunning reversal. His hatred of Stalin and his belief that the Bolsheviks were controlled by Jews formed the foundation of his worldview. Raising his voice, the dictator rationalized his actions. I am resolved to remove from the German frontiers the element of uncertainty, the everlasting atmosphere of conditions resembling civil war, he said. I will not war against women and children. I have ordered my air force to restrict itself to attacks on military objectives. This was a blatant lie. Even as he spoke, German bombs were killing Polish civilians. I will continue this struggle, no matter against whom, until the safety of the Reich and its rights are secured. If our will is so strong that no hardship or suffering can subdue it, then our will and our German might shall prevail. England and France soon declared war with Germany to honor their treaties with Poland. Millions of Americans feared the U.S. would be drawn into the war. Hitler's new alliance with the Soviets tipped the balance of power in Europe in Germany's favor. The next day, in her weekly syndicated newspaper column, Eleanor Roosevelt dismissed Hitler's speech. How can you say that you do not intend to make war on women and children, and then send planes to bomb cities? She asked. By mid-morning, journalists were packing the White House lobby, demanding explanations from Press Secretary Stephen Early. Behind the closed door of the president's office, Roosevelt was with Hugh Wilson, accepting Wilson's previously tendered resignation as ambassador to Germany, while seeking insights from him into Hitler's latest horror show. Secretary of State Cordell Hull joined them. At 10:40 a.m., the president signaled Early to admit the press, and he sounded the buzzer that alerted the reporters. Earl Godwin, who had been covering Roosevelt for years, was first into the room. A conservative former print reporter, Godwin was now an influential presence on the NBC Blue radio network. Seated behind a large mahogany desk in a green velvet swivel chair, American and presidential flags flanking him, the president pulled the cigarette holder from his mouth and asked Godwin, "What time did you get up?" "About 3 or 3:15, right after you aroused the nation. Felt like I belonged to the village fire department." "Yes, you were not the only one." As one last reporter was elbowing into the crowded room, Early called out, "All in!" Roosevelt had an easy rapport with the journalists nearly encircling him. Unlike predecessors, he regularly appeared, often twice a week, at lively press conferences, during which he made clear what was on the record and what was for background only. He was on a first-name basis with many reporters. Even news hounds who disagreed with him politically liked the man, and all honored an unspoken agreement never to write of his withered legs or photograph him in his wheelchair or being carried in and out of vehicles. Interactions between FBR and the press were usually playful and informal. Not so today. "I think a good many of us had a somewhat sleepless night," Roosevelt said. "Bill Hassett has told you of what happened at the White House last night, beginning at 2:50 a.m., I do not believe at this particular time of this very critical period in the world's history that there is anything which I can say except to ask for full cooperation of the press throughout this country in sticking as closely as possible to facts. Of course, that will be the best thing for our own nation, and I think for civilization." Rumors and falsehoods were swamping newsrooms nationwide, and the president stressed the need to prize accuracy over speed. The first question addressed exactly what everyone wanted to know. "I think what is probably uppermost in the minds of all the American people today is, can we stay out? Would you like to make any comment at this time?" Without hesitation, Roosevelt answered in strong, righteous tones. Only this, that I not only sincerely hope so, but I believe we can, and that every effort will be made by the administration so to do. May we make that a direct quote? Yes, the president replied with finality. That simple question, can we stay out, came to dominate political discourse in the United States for the next 2 years, with powerful voices demanding America isolate itself from the carnage of another European ground war. As the press conference ended, George Durno, the senior wire service reporter, ritually called out, "Thank you, Mr. President." Instantly, newsmen scrambled to be first to a bank of phones reserved for their use in the press room 2 doors over. Dashing past Secret Service agents stationed at the doorway, they crashed through Missy's office, around the huge round mahogany table in the lobby, and into the press room. In less than a minute, reporters were dictating the president's statement to newsrooms. The headline of the early afternoon edition of the Washington Evening Star read, "Roosevelt pledges every effort to keep U.S. out of war." London. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain summoned Winston Churchill to 10 Downing Street shortly after noon on September 1st. For years, Churchill had been in political exile, as his militant views on Hitler and Mussolini put him at odds with His Majesty's government. His strident calls from the backbenches of Parliament for an aggressive stance regarding Hitler earned him few friends. His disdain for and public disparagement of Chamberlain's policy of appeasement had made President Roosevelt see in Churchill a potential British partner. Chamberlain had little respect for American leadership, and Roosevelt thought the Prime Minister an appeaser and a fool. Churchill entered Downing Street with his customary quick step, smoking a cigar, and feeling vindicated for his predictions regarding the Nazis. Chamberlain, clearly shaken and unsure of what to do, met him in the cabinet room. "I see no hope of averting war," the Prime Minister said. "I shall have to form a small war cabinet of ministers without departments to conduct it. It would exclude the war, Admiralty, and RAF ministers. I hope to form a national coalition, but Labour has declined. I would like you to be a part of this." Churchill agreed. The two began discussing who should serve and who should not. Chamberlain assured Churchill that, "Unless Berlin ceases all aggressive action against Poland and withdraw their forces already there, His Majesty's government would fulfill its obligations to the Poles without hesitation." That promise languished for days. Before a session of Parliament that evening, with most members expecting a declaration of war, the Prime Minister again procrastinated, saying Whitehall was awaiting word from Berlin regarding the situation. Response to Chamberlain's meekness was overwhelmingly negative, even outraging members of his own cabinet. On September 3rd, Chamberlain finally went on the BBC to announce England was at war with Germany. Churchill addressed the next session of Parliament, delivering the first of many memorable wartime speeches. "Outside, the storms of war may blow, and the lands may be lashed with the fury of its gales, but in our own hearts this Sunday morning there is peace," he declared. "Our consciences are at rest. We are fighting to save the whole world from the pestilence of Nazi tyranny, and in defense of all that is most sacred to man." Chamberlain met with Churchill afterward and offered him the post he most intensely desired, First Lord of the Admiralty, the position he had held during the First World War. The concept of fighting Hitler to save the world would become the cornerstone of the complex relationship between Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. This notion of a global crusade also came to stand at the core of the argument that Roosevelt made to the American public as he struggled in coming years to lead their country away from an isolationist worldview and toward acceptance of America's rendezvous with destiny in defeating fascism. This defense of all that is most sacred to man was the essence of FDR's efforts to save the soul of America and inspire its citizens to rise to the challenge facing them. But before he could come to Churchill's aid, he had to walk the razor-thin line between truth and lies, agreeing America should remain neutral while secretly preparing for war. The White House. On the day that Churchill became First Lord, Roosevelt hosted key advisers at the White House to hone the text of the fireside chat he was to give that evening. One of his closest aides, Assistant Secretary of State Adolph Burrell, had submitted a draft, but FDR insisted on writing his own remarks. President Roosevelt sat at a table near the white marble fireplace in the Lincoln Study. He wore a short-sleeved shirt. Outside, the temperature was 85 degrees, and the swampy Potomac humidity made conditions feel even warmer. At 3:52 p.m., Burrell, Secretary of State Cordell Hull, Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells, and Assistant Secretary of War Lewis Johnson entered the room in silence. All were feeling the weight of history. Roosevelt distributed copies of his reworking of the speech. "Mr. President, this is a tremendous improvement over anything I have done," Burrell said. There was much discussion of the need to declare America's neutrality, with Secretary Hull insistent on language affirming that status as official U.S. policy. The meeting broke up at 5 p.m. Roosevelt had a quiet dinner with Missy LeHand and her assistant Grace Tully after the women had finished typing a final reading copy of his speech. At 8:55 p.m., a Secret Service agent wheeled Roosevelt into the diplomatic reception room. That space in the White House basement had been transformed into a broadcast studio from which the president had delivered many radio addresses. The 13-foot vaulted stone ceilings gave the room a feeling of depth and sanctuary, like a cathedral crypt. On this night, though, the makeshift studio was bustling with dozens of radio and newsreel technicians arranging and rearranging microphones, cables, and lights. At exactly 9 p.m., the president leaned in close to an array of microphones and began speaking to fellow Americans in a relaxed, clear voice, as one neighbor might talk with another over the dining room table. This was his 14th fireside chat, and one of his most important. "My countrymen and my friends, tonight my single duty is to speak to the whole of America," Roosevelt said. "Until 4:30 this morning, I had hoped, against hope, that some miracle would prevent a devastating war in Europe and bring to an end the invasion of Poland by Germany. For 4 long years, a succession of actual wars and constant crises have shaken the entire world and have threatened in each case to bring on the gigantic conflict, which is today, unhappily, a fact." Wherever the moment found them, millions of Americans were leaning toward radios, hanging on his every word. Fear of war was rampant, and the public craved reassurance from their leader that the United States was safe. Roosevelt denounced the invasion of Poland, and despite his own feelings to the contrary, the president delivered the words the State Department requested, a statement that America would remain neutral. But he offered an important caveat, inserting his personal perspective over his diplomat's objections. "But I cannot ask that every American remain neutral in thought as well," Roosevelt said. "Even a neutral has a right to take accounts of facts. Even a neutral cannot be asked to close his mind or his conscience." Just 3 days after the start of the war, Franklin Roosevelt addressed the issue that was to drive him for the next 2 years. The Neutrality Acts might prevent the country from taking sides in this conflict, but individual Americans had to decide for themselves what direction their moral compasses pointed. He later called this his quest to save the soul of America. Roosevelt knew in his heart that someday, perhaps soon, the United States would have to confront Hitler and fascism. But he repeated his oft-voiced declaration that, "I have said not once, but many times, that I've seen war and I hate war. I say it again and again. I hope the United States will keep out of this war. I believe that it will. And I give you assurance and reassurance that every effort of your government will be directed toward that end." And so President Roosevelt walked the razor's edge between truth and deception. He used words that would inform the public, without alarming them, while doing everything he could to prepare.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?